Hi, this is Judy Collins, and you're listening to the Since You've Asked podcast.
What I'll give you since you've asked is all my time together. Take the rugged sunny days, the and rocky weather. Take the roads that I have walked along, looking for tomorrow's time. Peace of mind.
Molly Jong Fast is, among other things, currently the editor-at-large with the Daily Beast, an American news publication focused on politics, media, and pop culture. She's the author of two novels, Normal Girl and The Social Climber's Handbook, and a memoir called Girl Maladjusted. I just want to read you what Kitty Kelly said about your book in her blurb for the book. She said, "Now we have the new Dorothy Parker." So let me introduce to you, to say hello, the new Dorothy Parker, my friend and the brilliant Molly Jong Fast. Hi, Molly.
Hi, thanks for having me, Judy. I'm so excited to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here with you. You know, I feel I've known you so long that I've known so well how talented you are and how extraordinary your life is. And of course, your mother and I have been friends for many years. And how do you feel about being the daughter and the granddaughter of talented writers?
I'm very lucky. I feel very lucky because it's given me a real leg up starting out. And I mean, I think it was also hard for me in certain ways, but my mother is very fun and she's been great. And what's nice about my mom is that I can write about her because she's written about me. We have that kind of death pact.
Yes.
Which is good. So, and, you know, and my grandfather was, you know, I don't think I understood how cool he was until he was dead a long time. And actually, you know, he had this incredible quote in his memoir about his FBI file and how everything in it was the good stuff that he had ever done. And actually the bad stuff wasn't in there. And, you know, the stuff he had done, like, speaking for labor unions, exactly, and the anti-racism stuff he did in the 50s and, so that kind of stuff and his work with Paul Robeson and that kind of stuff is probably the most interesting stuff about him. And I didn't even know that until he was dead. So I've actually been very, you know, I think you have heritage like that and you sort of resent it. And then you get to a place where you really respect it and appreciate it. So I feel very lucky now.
And in some ways, it almost sounds like a genetic fingerprint, because now, having been aware of him, but not as deeply aware, now you find yourself in a position where you're doing extraordinary work as a journalist. And your work has led you to be with, of course, the Daily Beast, which is, if nothing else, the conscience of a lot of us. You're writing about things we think about a lot and wonder what in the world can happen, but you're actually writing about these things. How does that feel to be come around in a way full circle?
Well, you know, what's interesting about my grandfather is that he did a lot of really important political work, especially with his, they would do these like rallies that were really huge at these communist rallies where they would, you know, and the Peekskill riots, things where they would give these concerts or these civil rights actions. It was sort of different back then. But my grandmother did write for the Daily Worker, forever and ever. So, yes, I mean, we're both on the opinion side, Grandpa and I. Yes. He didn't do, you know, he was much more opinion-y, and he wrote a lot of novels that sort of veered towards propaganda a little bit. That's something we don't do anymore, right? We don't write novels that are propaganda, historical novels that are propaganda anymore. You go back at them and you see they're very heavy-handed in a certain way, but they're also very interesting. I think the way we do content is different now, and there are certain things that Grandpa didn't have access to, but certainly the times are as terrifying.
Yeah.
And in some ways, I mean, my grandfather was, you know, was jailed for during the House on Un-American Activities for 3 months for being in contempt of Congress, for refusing to name names. And there was a group of them, and they went to the Supreme Court to try to have the conviction overturned, and instead they were just sent right to jail. So, and I think that it was, and then after that, he really felt like a stateless man for a number of years because he was scared of being put back in jail, and they went to Mexico. And I think that, you know, I don't know that I felt that way in the Trump administration. I mean, it wasn't the same kind of thing. Like, I never was brought into court and I was never jailed. But I certainly knew people like Kathy Griffin who were really, their whole lives were completely, you know, she was put on a no-fly list and put into different airports, you know, taken in to be interviewed by the FBI. And there were, and as we're seeing now, more and more different abuses of power. Like, the Trump administration kept different kinds of files on different people and had different. So, and I think we'll see more of that as things go on. Now, of course, the thing that's a little bit scarier is that there's a large part of America that still really thinks Trump is president and isn't really living in this world. So it's a little bit scary about what's going to happen with democracy in 2022 or even after that. So, yeah, I mean, I'm definitely worried.
Have you been able to write about that and diagnose and sort of dismember, if you'll pardon the expression, what went on the 6th? Have you done some of that writing?
I mean, there is a lot of writing about what went on the 6th. I don't know if I've written anything exactly about it, but it is, the revisionism about it is crazy. And I mean, like, one of the things Masha Gessen writes in New Yorker talks about is this idea that the only way to fight fascism is with narrative, right? Yes. So Democrats should be holding hearings about January 6th, and they should be having narrative, because Republicans are so good at obfuscating and are so working overtime to try to convince Americans that January 6th was not what we all know and saw on television. So I think that's really the job of Democrats. I'm quite worried, I have to say, about what happens with democracy now and if we can keep it. You know, I think that there's a large number of Republicans in this country who believe that the election wasn't free and fair, and they're working very hard to put these state level voting laws in place that will really that are quite scary. So I am really concerned about that. That's something that's a big worry for me.
In the topics of the Daily Beast, of course, the Daily Beast and your writing also have been known to reveal scandals, secret worlds, and facing bullies, hypocrites, and bigots head on. Now, you've never been one to hold back, which I've known about you all along. So this is extraordinary that you, first of all, you've written two quite wonderful books, three, including your biography, the one that Kitty Kelly began this hour with saying was, you are launching into a Dorothy Parker type existence in terms of the press. But as an editor, how does it feel to know that you expose a level of the world that is different than other publications that you've written for? Because I know you've written for some over the years, many.
I also write for Vogue. I do a column for Vogue on this, on, you know, what's going on right now. I would say, I think it's a very scary time. You know, I'm quite worried about what happens now in the Democratic Party. I don't think Democrats are taking it seriously enough. I don't think they're worried enough. I think that Republicans are extremely good at messaging in a way that Democrats are not. I think that Republican media is extremely activated, and that Rupert Murdoch is really controlling a large, there's a kind of, he has a kind of brilliance to him of the way Absolutely. He can control, you know, Fox, you know, he owns Fox News and the Washington Post, not the Washington Post, thank God, the Wall Street Journal. Yes. And their ad page has become very, you know, kind of place where, you know, you can see a story like the Hunter Biden email story go from the New York Post to the Wall Street Journal mm-hmm. to Fox News mm-hmm. and, you know, to Tucker Carlson. So there is a real ability for these people to kind of manipulate a large percentage of Americans. So I'm very worried about that. And I also think, you know, certain states are going to be unwinnable for Democrats because of these new restrictive voting laws. So Absolutely. States like Georgia, which flipped for Biden, and I think that, you know, what we saw with this pandemic was that because it was mail-in voting and because it was a pandemic, it was easier for people to vote. And as it got easier for people to vote, Republicans got more and more scared. And so they pushed back really hard on the local level on voting laws. And because Democrats haven't passed these voting laws in Congress, which I'm not sure they are going to, and I don't know how they would, because they need 10 sane Republicans in the Senate to pass it. I think it's a really scary and precarious time, so I'm worried.
I understand that in the course of your journey through the political personnel that we all know and love, that you became friendly with Hillary Clinton probably a number of years ago. And was that before her run for the White House, or was it during it or after it?
I mean, just after it. I wouldn't say that I was so friendly. I mean, I've met her a bunch of times, but I don't know her so well. I mean, I think what happened to her was really sort of shocking. But, you know, again, this is the thing I think that's so important, is this was a kind of, I mean, what happened to her really we saw was that the American media, and I mean straight journalists more than I mean anyone else, were unable to cover you had Hillary Clinton, who had certain things that people didn't like about her. They had hostility towards Bill. There were, you know, things like Whitewater and Monica Lewinsky and things that were problematic in their past. And these were sort of made false equivalencies to things like Trump's relationship with selling apartments to organized crime figures, right? Like there were, you know, the water was so muddied that it became, as you know, you had a Trump who had Paul Manafort, who had very, very inappropriate relationships with Russian oligarchs. Mm-hmm. So much so he shared polling, right? So you had these two cases that were not the same, right? One was Trump really veering on foreign assistance in American elections, which is not legal. And one was Hillary Clinton's, you know, the things that people resented about her because of Bill. Yeah. And these two things were not the same, but they really were treated like they were the same in 2016. Exactly. And I think that's how we ended up with the Trump presidency. And I also think there was a lot of really, you know, Russia got in there and sold us a lot of goods that were just completely crazy. And they got, and you know, the internet was, I mean, I think Twitter got very smart more recently at like deplatforming the kind of QAnon crazies, Trump. Yeah. But Facebook has had a real problem being able to do it. Like, and it's not really a problem. It's that they don't want
to. They don't want to.
And you see with Facebook, Facebook has been for years and years and years tied with anti-vaxxers. And like, what's really interesting about Facebook is, and it's so odd because the wife of Mark Zuckerberg is a doctor. So you'd think if there ever were a company where they wouldn't want to just completely destroy the world, by being anti-vaxxers, it would be this. But you will see there's actually information that shows that, you know, in places where Facebook comes, there is a higher level of anti-vaccines. Yeah. And so what you're seeing now in our country is you have this epidemic of anti-vaxxers, and then you have, you know, an epidemic of misinformation, a lot of which is coming from Facebook. So you have people like in Orange County, California is a really good example, where there are these young, affluent women who don't believe in vaccines anymore and also believe in crazy QAnon stuff that they have been told from Facebook. So I think you have this perfect storm of the death of local news, the rise of the internet, the rise of the internet as a news source, and this inability to you know, moderate content at all, that leads us to a very scary place.
If you were to think about two things that you could offer to your readers as solutions to be done on a private level in a mass of people that think the way you do and the way I do, what would you suggest as actions? We know about reactions. I mean, right. I know I'm sick on the floor with what's going on. I know that I can find relief in my work. But on the personal level of the guy who's sitting around with questions, what can I do? Where do I start?
I mean, I would say the most important thing is to support local news. Like, if you have one thing that you really want to do, it's, you know, the Texas Tribune and the Miami Herald. I mean, you have to be, you have to sort of look around. But I mean, subscribing to newspapers like the Washington Post and the New York Times and the Texas Trib, and there are a bunch of these nonprofit newsrooms that are coming up. Things like that are absolutely on the right side of things, right? Because you're finding content that is actually written by people. Yeah. And is edited by people, so you know it's legit. And so I would say that's a big thing. I think that's number one. And then I think number two is to try as hard as possible to get very involved in your local politics. So, for example, places like, I mean, that is one of those things where you think it's not such a useful thing, but it's actually very useful. So, you know, say you live in Maine. I mean, Maine is a state that is, a lot of these states are, you know, run for school board, run for dog catcher, run for anything. And even like, even if you've never run for office or you're older, I mean, there's such a, there are so many seats every year that don't get people running for them. And especially in some ways in red states, even if a Democrat loses, running it increases support for Democrats, increases education, shows people kind of the real truth of things. So I am a big fan of that. And then there's all sorts of other kind of news literacy organizations. And the more you can do with supporting that kind of thing, the better. But the absolute first way to support kind of the good is to subscribe to your local
news. Absolutely. Yeah. I qualify on both counts. I'm older and I have never run.
Yep. And you so can do it.
That makes it something obviously that I could do.
You certainly
many people could do.
Yeah.
I will figure out whether it's dog catcher or president, but I think it is a choice that I'll have to make now that we're having this conversation.
And, you know, if you're friends with Matthew McConaughey, you could mention to him that he should run for governor of Texas.
Absolutely.
Because I know he's thinking about it, and it's the only way Democrats are ever going to win that governorship.
Yeah.
And he's polling better than Governor Abbott. So if you want to give him a phone call, yes. If that happens, Dayenu, it will have all been worth it. You know, so it's true. But yeah, so I mean, that's the thing. And also just to encourage people, I mean, that, is, you know, to not think it's too late, because it's really not too late.
No. It's always the time that it is, which, of course, you and I have learned the hard way. Speaking of which, let's talk a little bit about the pandemic. I know I've seen you on and off, and I've seen you in your home, and I know you, and I knew your family, and I love that you met your husband, Matt, online. Isn't that right?
It's great. He's the best.
Wonderful man.
Yeah.
And so I know that you've had a family life, of course, and you, like everybody else, has had to do some Zooming teaching at home. How has that gone for you? How has that been?
Well, it's now the kids are all back in school, so that's great.
Yeah.
Love having the kids back in school. The Zooming has been fine. I feel very lucky. You know, none of us got the virus. And my parents, too, everybody was okay. So
everybody's
really what matters. And then we all got vaccinated, which was really fabulous.
Me too.
And and my little ones have one more vaccine and then they're done. That's been great. I felt really great about that. And, you know, I think it's one of those things where you know, I feel like there has been a lot of hardship, like a lot of financial hardship and a lot of physical hardship, right? A lot of people have gotten COVID and had long COVID. A lot of people have lost jobs and livelihood. And you see, I mean, right now there's like this spike in crime, which is due to the fact that a lot of people were financially very disenfranchised by this pandemic. So I feel very much that very lucky because we didn't have that.
Yeah.
But so I hate to sort of speak out of school because I know there's been a lot of suffering and we've lived through a lot of suffering. And like even in New York, we saw firsthand a lot of suffering, you know. So, and I had a lot of friends who've lost their dads, and it's been, I think, a very tough time. So, you know, I've had a fine time, but I feel kind of bad even saying it because it has been such a terrible time. And, you know, we lost, you know, a little more than 500,000 Americans, right? Yeah. And millions of people worldwide. So the suffering, and in India, I mean, and it continues and continues. And I think that's been really hard. So, but we are so lucky. I mean, there have been so many things that have gone right with this pandemic, from the vaccine being good and working on the variants to, I mean, we have gotten lucky at every point. So we've really been lucky, you know, the virus sucked but we've gotten very lucky with the vaccines, and we got lucky with Biden. And now today, 50% of all Americans are vaccinated. I mean, it's crazy. And this vaccine is very safe. I mean, millions of people have been vaccinated.
I want to ask you if you have conceived of doing another novel after your two novels and your autobiography. Have you felt the need to launch into a new novel yourself?
I actually am doing another book. I'm doing a nonfiction book about the 1990s.
Ooh.
So, and it's like a little bit memoir, but it's also like a little bit of the sort of interesting, you know, you know, it's interesting because there just aren't that many books about it, because that was why I decided to write about it, because there weren't that many books about it. Because it's sort of close enough, so people are still sort of like, it feels like yesterday. But it's actually 20 plus years ago.
I feel as though I have the poignancy of the 90s for me. So much happened, so many contrasting things. As you know, my son Clark died in the 90s, in 92. And it's hard for me to remember to conceive of the fact that how long ago that was and how yesterday, it's like yesterday.
Yeah.
And getting through it made all the difference in a way in my own life, because it made me have to think about things and work through things that I didn't want to have anything to do with. And so it was a powerful decade for me, two decades, really. Three. It's almost three now.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going on. It was 92. So it's now it's good Lord.
32 years.
29 years or something since it all happened. And I know you knew Clark. And so we don't necessarily want to talk about you know what.
I'm mad about it.
Oh, good. I want to talk about it a little bit because I see this shining, brilliant, marvelous woman in front of me, whom I knew when she wasn't so shiny and beautiful.
Actually, one of my last drinking, it wasn't even one of my, it was July 1997, and we were at St. John the Divine at an event, and I was drinking red wine, and it was stuck to my teeth, and I saw you and Susan Cheever, and you were both looking at me the way sober people look at drunk people when they know they need to be in AA.
Yes, yes. And, of course, I know. I mean, I was privy to being sober and knowing how hard that is to be not sober, and referencing always my own horrible stories, which I guess we all have horrible stories about what it was like to be an addict, to be at the mercy of an addiction, which was trying to kill you. Yeah. And what do we do to get out of it? And quite frankly, you know, I went into treatment in 1978. Jeez. I had my last drink on the 19th of April of 1978. And there was no way that I was ever going to stop. I mean, I never tried to stop in all these years. Yeah. I never tried to stop. I didn't try to control. I controlled the results. I tried, I thought. But it was a nightmare to be in. And so here I'm looking at you, this bright, shining, wonderful, healthy, productive genius sitting in front of me. And I think when we know people before and then we see them after, we're always astonished. I mean, if that doesn't get you, then, you know, the water turning into wine has nothing on that.
It's so true. I mean, I'm 23 years sober.
Yeah, that's amazing.
But I love that you're sober more than I am old.
So I was
born in August 1978. And I got sober in November 2nd, 1997. I went to Hazelden, which you helped me go to. And I've been sober since then. And it is, I mean, I'm very grateful. Like, I feel like I see, you know, I have many people in my family who are not sober. So I see how this disease is just, the thing that I worry the most about is the mind. You know, it's your mind.
Of course.
And it really grinds down your intellect in a way that is just so crushing.
Yes.
And that is really my worst fear of it, is that is just it gets at your brain and eats away at your brain cells in a way that is just grim.
It's grim. And in a way, it's grimmer than dementia, because dementia in most people that have it has come about for unknown reasons. Well, we know that alcohol does that to the brain without the advantages of being fashionable or understandable or even treatable, except to get sober. You know, the big piece that Ken Burns did recently on Hemingway was very interesting, because it of course, we all know that he committed suicide. We all know that he was drinking all the time. We all know the kind of lifestyle he had. And yet, throughout this, how many, 2, 4, 6 hours, people yeah. are celebrating that he shoots the elephants, you know, that he catches the fish, that he has incredibly interesting relationships with everybody he ever met. Some of them are brilliant. Most of them are brilliant. But nobody talks about alcohol except Mary Carr. And she's right. a guest on the show. And she says a couple of times, it's the alcohol. It's the drinking. Right. And you can happen to have this problem. And eventually you become, if you are an alcoholic, it becomes worse. And it becomes worse. And then you die
yeah.
from alcoholism. And, or you get sober.
Yeah.
And when you see it starkly like that, and so many people don't get sober, I think the statistics are that 10% of us here in this country, probably worldwide, I don't know, have this addiction of some sort, one or another form of addiction yeah. that can kill you, and that about 2% of us get help. You and I are among the 2%. We're so fortunate, and who knows why? Nobody knows why, except right. that. We like to think we were in the right place at the right time, perhaps, when yeah. we were exposed to the work that is done by these two gentlemen who met in Akron. And what they did, in other words, the treatment that they had was they sat in a room and told each other their stories about their yeah. drinking. Now, and it's for free.
Yeah, it's the only free thing in the world.
It's the only free thing we have. I always say to people, if you have anything that could get you into a 12-step program, any kind of go like mad, run, do not walk.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a solution.
It's
so great that we do.
Absolutely true.
We do.
Yeah.
And I'm thrilled that you're contemplating another book because you're a fine writer.
And yeah, no, I'm writing this other writer. Book.
And you're yeah. funny. You're funny. You've always been funny. I mean, that is clear that from the very beginning, I knew that Molly Jongfast was going to be able to write in the way that she speaks. She's funny. She has a sense of humor. I don't trust people who don't have a sense of humor,
it's
quite frankly.
True.
Thank you for listening to the Since You've Asked podcast.